Case number 14-7193 et al. Susan Weinstein, individually as co-administrator of the estate of Ira William Weinstein and as natural guardian of plaintiff David Weinstein, minor et al. Appellant versus Islamic Republic of Iran et al. Mr. Katz for the appellant, Mr. Francisco for the appellees.
Good morning. Mayor Katz on behalf of plaintiffs and appellants. My clients are victims of terrorism, suffered mightily at the hands of Iran, Syria, and North Korea, and for that received judgments in excess of approximately $250 million compensatory damages cumulatively, $1.75 billion punitive damages. Haven't been able to collect anything. The governments of Iran, North Korea, and Syria, that's incorrect. They haven't been able to collect materially anything. They've collected some small amounts. The governments of Iran, North Korea, and Syria haven't paid, and they're not going to pay. They've made it very clear. Congress tried to address this problem through four separate enactments, culminating in 28 U.S.C. 1610G, to enable victims of terrorism to go through the legal process, through a process driven by attorneys and through the court system, to find assets that others haven't found, and try to collect the limited assets of Iran, North Korea, and Syria that exist in the United States. The Internet is run by and through ICANN, at least at the root zone level, at the highest level of the Internet. Iran, North Korea, and Syria have internet assets. They have country code top level domain names and IP addresses that again are operated through by and through ICANN in California and in DC. So my clients attempted to attach those assets. They did attach those assets in the District of Columbia through writ of attachment using the process supplied by DC statute. And the court below quashed that writ of attachment, not allowing any discovery, not allowing us to submit any substantive argument at all. We requested additional time by motion through following discovery, and the district court didn't allow that, finding that it could reach the questions on threshold questions of law under D.C. law. That was an abuse of discretion on two levels. First of all, it misapplied D.C. law. And in reliance on the misapplication of D.C. law, that formed the basis of its decision to deny discovery. And secondly, it didn't even reach the question of the IP addresses at all. It simply didn't address them. That's not the fault of the district court, certainly. ICANN didn't raise the issues. And it's and because we didn't get the opportunity to provide substantive briefing in response, the district court apparently wasn't even aware that the IP addresses were attached. But nevertheless, it was an abuse of discretion not to allow discovery on that question without even addressing the issue, without reaching substantive points of law. Instead, it applied Virginia law, a peculiar statute that relies on the existence of liabilities, quote-unquote liabilities, between the garnishee and the judgment debtor. The liability requirement does not exist under D.C. law. And what the court in Umbro held, that the district court applied, the court in Umbro held that because a domain name is not a liability owned to the judgment debtor, that non-liability can't be attached because, again, the Virginia statute requires the existence of a liability. Umbro did not reach the question of whether domain names are property. It addressed it. It acknowledged that one of the parties believed that it was property, but didn't reach the question as tukes.com, the 28J case that we sent you recently, CRS Recovery and Sprinkler Warehouse, all make clear, among other cases. Umbro is an outlier. It's not persuasive. Even if it weren't an outlier, an outlier is probably too weak. It's the only case, except for a couple that rely on Umbro, that reached this question and decided it in the manner that Umbro did. It's not persuasive. And it's not relevant to CCTLDs. Because country code top-level domain names, unlike secondary to second-level domain names, do not receive services at any substantial level beyond the de minimis services that ICANN provides in changing or directing the change to the root zone code one time. And because of that, because the secondary domain, the top-level domain names are not recipients of services on a regular basis, the analysis in UMBRO, relevant to the provision of services that the top-level domain name gives to the secondary domain name, which, again, it isn't applicable here at that higher level, the analysis doesn't apply at all. Moreover, regarding the question of the provision of services that I can't rely so heavily on, it's a mistake, because properties attached on a regular basis, without regard to the whether there's a provision of services, without regard to the question of services that animated AMBRO so much and ICANN's briefing, for example, apartment buildings, co-ops, any leasehold. These are all not every leasehold, but many leaseholds. Property with an easement on it. These are all examples of real property that maybe not in the hands of a garnishee, but certainly when you're going after the judgment debtor, are certainly attachable. There's a provision of services very often. There are limitations on the use of property. Nevertheless, it's attachable. It's attachable subject to the limitations, certainly. But the existence of limitations is not a reason not to allow attachment. D.C. statute entitles the judgment creditors to discovery. It's a provision in the code. We're entitled to deposition. Entitled to interrogatories. We submitted interrogatories. ICANN responded with one word, essentially, no. Provided no information of any relevance. Didn't submit to deposition, not that we directly demanded that they do so. Instead, we requested significant discovery beyond just deposing ICANN, deposing third parties explained at great length, and the district court again did not allow it. Reaching these issues on this record would do a great injustice to my clients, first of all. It would do a great injustice to the top-level domain name managers around the world who aren't represented here, who are being told by ICANN that their property is not property. Property that is similar property that has been sold in one instance for $107 million, referring to the Columbia.co domain name, which is referenced in the appendix. It was a sale of that asset for $107 million. Other assets that have been similarly transferred, the details of which are not exactly reflected in the record. And again, that's because there's been no discovery.
Can I ask you, assuming that they are property, I have two questions about D.C. law, which are actually questions generally about the common law of attachment. So one requirement is that the creditor can't obtain more rights in the property than the debtor, right? Than the judgment debtor. That's what we said in Heiser, right? And secondly, that the garnishee has to have the property in its hands. It has to be in possession of the property.
Correct.
That both of those are correct.
Generally, yes.
Well, that's what the D.C. statute specifically talks about, in the hands of, and talks about possession. And
yes, but it's talking about physical property mostly. That particular statute you're referring to.
It has to be in possession of something.
When you're talking about intangible property, it's obviously a legal fiction. And so to talk about it in that sense is a little bit challenging. But okay. And it's not.
So my question, I just want to understand exactly what we're talking about here. As I read your attachment letter, you want the CCTLD, I'm going to just talk about Iran just because it's easier, of Iran. One thing, the government of Iran's IP address says, and the ministry's IP addresses, correct? Those are the three things. The way in which you would get the CCTLD of Iran is by updating an entry in the root zone directory. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay, so starting with that one, does Iran have the power to require ICANN to make that change?
Does Iran have the power?
Yeah, because they're the judgment debtor, right?
Yes.
Since you can't get any more power than the judgment debtor has, could Iran make ICANN make that change?
I'll respond directly, but first I think that's a misstatement of the law.
Okay.
We can't take more interest than Iran has.
Uh-huh.
But that doesn't mean that we can't do things that Iran can't do. Because the rules say, the Heiser, for example, says that, again, you can't attach more than the judgment debtor has. But that doesn't mean that through the legal process, through court order, we can't do things that Iran by itself wouldn't be able to do. There's a decision by this court Washington Loan and Trust, 1902, I think, cited at the end of our reply brief, which says that it was talking about a safe deposit box, where there's two keys, obviously. The bank has one key, and the owner of the box has another key. The court says that the court is grappling with this issue because the judgment debtor, whose property is being attached, only has one of the keys. The judgment debtor by himself can't open the box. And the court says that's irrelevant. It would be very strange to look at law that way,
The judgment debtor, in that case, the holder of the safe deposit box, has the power to require the bank to open his safe deposit box. If I get a safe deposit box, I get a key. Obviously, the bank gets a key. And by my contract with the bank, they've got to open it when I want it open, right?
There are limitations. I mean, it's 3 in the morning. They can't demand it.
Yeah, okay. But at some point, the bank has to be willing to open it. Otherwise, nobody would ever get a safe deposit box. Does Iran have that authority over ICANN?
I believe the answer is yes.
And in what way?
First of all, this gets back to the record issue. The record is not developed, and we haven't had the opportunity to develop it. It's extremely important to answering this question. I don't think the court can or should reach this issue.
Well, give me an idea of how it
works. Sure. Iran owns this property. It belongs to Iran. It was developed by John Postel. The process by which it transferred is not developed by anyone, I don't think.
I'm asking. I'm assuming that for the purposes of this argument. If Iran says, I want to transfer my .ir to, I don't know, Korea or something, is there anything requires ICANN to do that?
There are limitations. I mean, if they want to transfer it to Korea, that would be difficult because the .ir is obviously intended for the people of Iran.
Yeah.
And so giving it to Korea would create problems. Uh-huh. Giving it to somebody who doesn't have the ability to manage it, doesn't have the technical skills to be able to manage it properly would be a problem. And those limitations need to be abided by. But beyond that, it's not ICANN's role to say yes or no if it belongs to Iran. ICANN is not Congress. ICANN doesn't create law.
Could Iran sue ICANN if ICANN refuses to do this and force them to allow the change to a different...
I don't see why not. Yes.
Okay. And now, does ICANN have possession of the CCTLDs?
Does ICANN have possession? Again, we're talking about an intangible asset. But
I'm sorry, I understand that. But the statute
said that several times. Intangible assets can be possessed.
Yeah. Yes. But
it doesn't follow if you call it intangible, you can't possess it. I mean, one of the prime examples is a trade secret. Would you say the company that's manufacturing a particular product in accordance with their trade secrets doesn't possess the trade secret?
Of course they do, Your Honor. They own the trade secret. The word possess has connotations that don't apply to an intangible asset. But certainly is, and for the purposes that we're talking, I mean, absolutely a trade secret is owned and possessed by the party that created it. Your question again, Judge Garland. Sorry.
Well, I thought that the CCTLDs had been delegated to the registry managers.
That's the process by which ICANN gave them out. But,
yes.
Again, ICANN created them for a specific purpose. It was to benefit Iran and its subjects. ICANN describes the process by which it gives CCTLDs out and takes them away and gives them to other people as delegation, suggesting that it's done entirely on a discretionary basis. But that's ICANN's nomenclature. I mean, that has nothing to do with the way that the law ought to look at CCTLDs.
Well, you talk about reclaiming them. I just wonder, what does that mean?
Reclaiming them on behalf of Iran. Is that your question?
That ICANN can reclaim them from Iran.
That's the IP addresses we're talking about.
Okay. So So how was it going to? I see. They'd have to update the entry in the root zone directory. That's what you said, right?
Correct. That's all that would happen.
And who has the root zone directory?
It's currently in the hands of VeriSign.
Right. So why shouldn't this case be brought against VeriSign in Virginia rather than against ICANN in Washington?
Well, that's a good question. ICANN is in charge. I mean, VeriSign is essentially a custodian. I don't believe that they have any discretionary role whatsoever. They're hired to do what they're told to do by ICANN. So it's not, for example, if you have a security company that's watching a vacation home in North Carolina, let's say, I'm not there the whole year. The security company doesn't own the house. I do. Right? So, I mean, they're custodian over the asset in terms of, again, making specific changes to it. But it belongs to the federal government, ultimately. It's in the possession of ICANN under the control of ICANN.
So if it belongs to the federal government, can Iran really make it do anything?
Can Iran make the federal government do anything?
Our federal government, yeah. So that is, if Iran wanted to change the root zone directory to make a sale like you're talking about, you couldn't make our federal government do anything.
The CCTLD belongs to Iran. The root zone belongs to the federal government. Mm-hmm. The root zone...
But it would have to make a change in the root zone in order to get what you want, right?
That's correct. I mean, it's an interesting problem. I mean, but if you assume that the federal government has the right to say, we're not doing anything, this is our property, we're doing nothing with it, it would shut the Internet down. They certainly don't assert that right. They never have it. In their brief, they make clear that they have no role.
Right, but So each of you assume the opposite of what actually turned out to be a useful position for you. If you take the position that it's owned by the United States, then Iran can't make it do anything. If they take the position it's not owned by anybody, then maybe Iran can. So I'm a little not wanting to resolve that question for the very reasons that you presented in your brief. I'm trying to assume it is correct, that you are correct about it. And in that case, I'm having trouble figuring out exactly what to do about this possession problem of the CCTLD.
The asset is controlled again by Iran. Controlled by ICANN. And because it's controlled by ICANN and under the auspices of ICANN, ICANN has the authority, the government gave it the authority, to make changes to it. I don't know that the government's, certainly given the government's position, I don't know that the government's interest in the root zone plays any role here. Given again, because the government has taken the position that it has no role to play. And I think that the government taking that position explicitly before this court ought to play a significant role in that discussion.
Let's suppose you win. What do you do with the top level .IR? What do you do?
We would either license it or sell it to a party that has the ability, recognized by ICANN ideally somebody that's already administering the top-level domain name, and there are plenty of private companies that do that, to then operate the .IR on some kind of, if it's a license, on some kind of royalty basis.
What happens to all the holders of the secondary domain names?
Absolutely nothing. They would not notice any change at all. It would be a seamless transition. The only difference is when they want to pay at the end of the year to renew their second-level domain name, they would pay a different address. That would be the only difference. Because the transition would have to be seamless. It would totally disrupt the Internet, and that's not our goal, certainly. And that's not what would happen. We would make sure that it would be a seamless transition to whoever we licensed or sold it to. And the second-level domain names would operate again without any interruption at all. It would just be complete. As long as the root zone is adjusted as would have to be according to court order in a timely way, instead of directing traffic to address A, would direct it to address B, and everything else would operate as before.
You know, I can understand if the top-level domain name was something like TV, why and that was that Tuvalu island chain, that did something. I'm not sure it's a sale or a lease or whatever, but what value is there in IR other than designating Iran?
Well, if you're Iranian, it's high value. I'm saying that people want to have, for whatever reason, somebody gets a .IR domain name. They want to have association with that nationality. I mean, that's what .IR represents. But I think your question ultimately gets to marketability. And if the question is, this asset isn't worth very much, so be it. I mean, that's what the market will bear, and that's the amount that we'll recover. We're not going to recover more than the asset's worth, but we certainly want that amount, whatever it is. And I think we're entitled to it.
Can I ask you the same question now about the IP addresses?
Sure.
Were they not already allocated to the regional registries and then from there down to the ISPs and to around?
The answer is yes, and that's the only question I think the record can establish. Everything else about this is very fuzzy because there is no record. The reason that I think it's not a problem, first of all, when you're talking about large blocks of addresses, which is what happens with a country like Iran with a massive military program and a massive Internet program and presence, the assets are allocated from the intermediate registry, the regional registry, to Iran in enormous blocks. If the block that the registry received from ICANN is undivided and transfers in kind to Iran, the path from ICANN to Iran is very straightforward. It's not that at no point is the registry really getting involved in the asset. That's one. getting involved in dividing up the asset, getting involved in the allocation of the asset because...
I'm sorry for the coughing. Aren't the IP addresses now reallocated to individual machines and individual users? And
that's done by RAM.
Yes, but you want them back.
We will, right. I mean,
and how would you get them back? They'd have to, in other words, this again goes to the question I was asking before. They're not in the possession of ICANN. They would have to somehow be reclaimed from ICANN. Is that right?
So that's point two. ICANN is in control of these things from the very beginning. And they remain in control of all, even the addresses that are allocated individually. The registries don't actually do that. But, you know, an internet service provider, for example, Verizon, will give out a single IP address to where it needs to go. Maybe. I mean, again, that's not established on the record. But that the asset is nevertheless controlled by ICANN in the sense that in order to operate, it needs to be centralized. It wouldn't work if it wasn't centralized.
But what is it that ICANN would have to do? If you were to succeed in attaching the IP addresses, what would you want ICANN to do about it?
Cause the IP address to be assigned to a different machine. And how does it do that?
What does it have to change in order to do that?
That's a technical question I personally don't even know the answer to.
I guess the question is, how does it fit within the attachment statute, which talks about the asset being in the hands of, credit being in the hands of, possession, all those kind of words?
It's in the hands of ICANN in the sense that ICANN controls it. ICANN has control over these assets.
You talk about sort of reclaiming them, and I'm unsure what you mean by that.
It was probably a poor word choice.
It actually metaphorically sounds like I can understand it, but so.
In the context, that's what we were, you know. But anyway,
I thought the IP addresses were distributed in a block to equipment manufacturers. Is that wrong?
I believe that's wrong. I believe that's wrong. It's assigned at the local level, so to speak, by an internet service provider or by a country.
But if I go out and buy a laptop, it already has an IP address on it.
I don't believe that's true. It has 192.168, which is a local address, but that address is local to your home network. It's not an address that was assigned by the manufacturer. Okay. There are no further questions. Thank you, Your Honor.
Chief Judge Garland, may it please the Court, Noel Francisco for ICANN. Chief Judge Garland, I'd like to first address your question about Iran's authority in this area. And then, Judge Randolph, I'd like to address your question about what would happen to the second-level domain names, because I think they go to the critical issues in this case, which is whether or not these country code top-level domain names are attachable property. I think that's the easiest way to resolve this without getting into the more esoteric questions as to whether they're property in some sense, even if you assume there's some sort of property.
So you want to skip the grounds on which the district court decided the case?
No, Your Honor, because I think the district court didn't address whether they're property. He was quite clear that he wasn't addressing that question. He held that they weren't attachable property. Mm-hmm. Here there are three basic principles of D.C. attachment law that each independently foreclose the attempt to attach the CCTLDs. The first, Chief Judge Garland, is the one that you put your finger on when you asked what Iran's ability was to force ICANN to transfer a CCTLD from one manager to another. And the answer is all Iran has the ability to do is make a request, the same way you could make a request or the same way I could make a request.
But that is not anything the district court said, though.
No, Your Honor. That was not the basis upon which the district court resolved this decision, but it is a basis upon which you can affirm the district court below.
If we're satisfied that the facts are as you put them rather than as the facts are as the opposing counsel puts them.
Well, no, Your Honor, because on this issue there's not even a factual dispute. They've never disputed the fact that
disputing it when I asked them.
Well, but if you look at what they actually sought discovery on, they never sought discovery on any of this. I think if you look at page 17 of the blue brief, they talk about what they want discovery on. They want discovery on ICANN's assertion that the attached internet assets are not property. I'm assuming for the sake of argument that they are in some sense property. And they want discovery on whether ICANN is unable to transfer the assets. So they're not questioning that ICANN plays a role. They're simply questioning whether ICANN has the sole authority or whether ICANN can only do it with the concurrence of the Department of Commerce.
All right. If the question is whether they've conceded this, I'm going to ask them afterwards.
Sure, Your Honor, but they certainly have not sought discovery on that. And on that question, it's quite clear that the transfer of a CCTLD from one manager to another is a multi-stakeholder process in which ICANN and the Department of Commerce have separate and independent roles, and they don't dispute that basic fundamental point. That's what underscores how what the plaintiffs are trying to get here is greater power in the underlying CCTLDs than Iran, Syria, and North Korea have. If Iran, Syria, and North Korea have no ability to transfer the CCTLD from one manager to another, then it's an inappropriate use of the garnishment process to force the very type of transfer that the purported owners of the property couldn't do themselves. I'd also like to turn to the issue upon which the district court did resolve this case, because I think you...
So there are three principles of attachment.
Yes.
Before we get to the district courts, what's your other one?
So the principle of attachment law that we were just discussing was that the judgment creditor can't get any more power than the judgment
debtor. Second one?
Excuse me?
And the second?
The second is the one that the district court relied upon, which is...
Can we skip to the third?
Then? Sure. The third one is that goods and chattels are limited to tangible personal property.
Right, so the one I was asking about, that it has to be in the hands of, is not one of your three?
No, that also, if you assume esoterically, I add a fourth. If you assume esoterically that this is property in some sense, neither the CCTLDs nor the underlying IP addresses, I would say, are being held or are currently in ICANN's possession. They have certain abilities over CCTLDs, certain roles in the transfer from one to another. They don't have that same role with respect to the IP addresses, but I don't think in either way could you say that they're in their hands.
All right, I interrupted you. You have two other.
Sure.
What are the other two?
So I would like to defend the basis upon the judgment below, because I think it was absolutely correct. And that's the first principle, that you cannot use garnishment law to insert yourself into the middle of an ongoing relationship to provide services. Here, what plaintiffs effectively want to do is to force internet users in Iran, Syria, and North Korea to purchase internet services from either them or their designee. To give an example, suppose I had a contract with the government of Iran where I paid them money in order to provide me with legal services. What plaintiffs are effectively trying to do is step into Iran's shoes and force me to purchase legal services from them. Well, that is simply an inappropriate use for use of garnishment law.
So the problem that I have with the district court's opinion is that it's based on the Umbro case. And the Umbro case is based only resolves the question of second-level domains. And it says that you can't attach second-level domains.
Mm-hmm.
That seems to me very unlikely to be D.C. law.
I think that it's based not just on the Umbro case. It's also based on the general principle
agree that at least as far as D.C., it's unlikely that D.C. would say that, I don't know, porno.com, which you can imagine what they do, and they owe a lot of money to extraporno.com, and they don't pay. And extraporno would be able to attach them, just like in California they're able to attach, and in Minnesota they're able to attach. Doesn't that seem likely in the development now?
I don't know, Your Honor, but that's clearly distinguishable, because I can take the porno.com. I have the right to control the porno.com second-level domain name. I have no obligation to actually use it. Say I'm a member of the Christian Right and I don't want it to be used. I can purchase it, stick it on a shelf, and let it collect dust. The same is not true when it comes to a top-level domain name. The sole function of assigning a manager to a top-level domain name is to impose upon them the duty to operate that name. And that's why, with respect to top-level domain names, the underlying property, assuming for the sake of argument that we're going to call it property, is completely inseparable from the duty to operate the CCTLD. And plaintiffs are quite candid in what they want. They want to either be able to operate it themselves or, as counsel just explained, license it to somebody else to operate it. So, in other words, they're trying to force internet users in these countries to purchase a bundle of services from either them or their designee. It's not just Umbro that makes clear why that's inappropriate. It's also cases like Cummings General Tire and Shipritz, D.C. Court of Appeals cases. I'm not going to tell you that those cases are squarely on all fours.
Yeah.
They're not. but they stand for the basic proposition that when you've got an ongoing relationship to provide services, garnishment isn't an appropriate way to insert yourself into the middle of that in order to essentially attach the payments that flow from the use of those services. And under certification law, you don't need a D.C. case on all fours in order for this court to resolve it. You just need a discernible path to resolution. Here I would submit that those cases, along with Umbro, which stands for the same basic principle, you might disagree with how they applied the principle and the facts of Umbro, but the basic principle is the same principle as in Cummings and Shipritz. That provides a discernible path to resolution, and again, it's not an issue upon which plaintiffs have sought discovery in this case. The third basis is the cleanest legal basis to resolve this, and there's absolutely no question on anybody's part as to whether discovery is necessary. And that's the meaning of the phrase goods and chattels in the D.C. attachment law. As this court held in the Heiser case, when it comes to interpreting garnishment statutes, D.C. applies the strict construction rule. That means you have to adopt the narrowest reasonable interpretation of the words in order to safeguard the rights of innocent third-party garnishees like ICANN. And in the Parsons case, the case that
Heiser is talking about is a due process case. It's about the due process provided to the garnishee. It's not about what is the subject of garnishment. And as I read the D.C. cases, they are, I'm just going to try to find them. Rowe says, goods and chattels mean all categories of property and all rights and interests in property. That is as broad as can be.
Well, I disagree with that reading of Roe, Your Honor. Roe involved the execution of a judgment in a municipal court. The specific statute that applied to the execution of a judgment in a municipal court did not use the phrase goods and chattels. It is true that there's some dicta in Roe that separately discusses a different statute that wasn't applicable in that case.
So all that means is that there isn't a case directly on point, but as you told me a few minutes ago, all we have to do is be able to discern the path. And the Court of Appeals there is pretty much explaining the path, there's a long discussion about this. We're no longer going to distinguish between law and equity. We're no longer going to distinguish between tangible and intangible. These words mean everything, all kinds of property.
Except, Your Honor, that much more recent D.C. case law makes a much clearer discernible path. And that's the strict construction rule. In Heiser, they were citing D.C. Court of Appeals case law that stands for the basic proposition that's widely accepted in other courts as well, that when you interpret garnishment statutes, you need to construe them narrowly in order to safeguard the rights of third-party garnishees. So you start with that strict construction rule, which requires you to adopt a narrower rather than...
And the statute here, what is it, subsection G3, says essentially that too.
Yes, Your Honor, exactly. And then when you combine that with the D.C. Court of Appeals' far more recent decision in Parsons, which involved trusts and estates, made crystal clear that one common definition of goods and chattels is limited to tangible personal property.
Yeah, but I'm sorry, but that's one, if I'm correct about that, that's one where you take the context of the will and you make that it could be read either way, but that the more common way is it covers everything. And in the context of that case and that will, they said that they were going to read it narrowly. But that's not...
Well, the will didn't actually use the phrase goods and chattels. They were discussing the phrase goods and chattels and explaining how one common understanding of the phrase goods and chattels
says
was
normally
limited to...
A bequest of personal property includes every form of personal property from whatever source it may be derived. The context may show that it's limited to tangible. And in the context of this will, they decided it was.
Yeah, but if you continue that sentence, Your Honor, it would limit it to tangible personal property, which is one definition of goods and chattels.
Yes, one meaning of, right.
Yeah.
But there are other meanings.
I would concede that there are different definitions of goods and chattels when you look out at the various sources.
So how would you say it's limited? What do you think goods and chattels
means? Sure. What it means is tangible personal property.
Only tangible?
Yes, Your Honor, when you construe it in light of the strict construction rule. Because the strict construction rule requires you to adopt the narrower construction.
So
in fact, I think
copyrights can't be attached.
Under the D.C. attachment law, limited to goods, chattels, and credits. For example, it also includes the word credits.
Yeah.
If goods and chattels does actually include all intangible property, the term credits would be completely superfluous. So let me even assume, for the sake of argument, that there's some category of intangible property that gets swept into the phrase goods and chattels. It certainly doesn't include the most esoteric form you could imagine, this thing that we call a CCTLD.
Just to be clear, so you are saying second-level domain names can't be attached in the District of Columbia. That's your view.
Not as a good chattel or credit. That's true.
Then how?
Your Honor, there may be, I think you're probably right, that they can't be attached. That doesn't mean they're not property. That doesn't mean they're not subject to conversion. That doesn't mean they're not subject to everything else. But when you take a statutory phrase like goods, chattels, and credits, combine it with a strict construction rule, and a clear, recent D.C. Court of Appeals decision stating that one common understanding of that term is limited to tangible personal property, that's the construction you should apply. And I would submit that the fact that it can be broader in the trusts and estates context actually helps us. What the case law makes clear in D.C. is that when you're interpreting a will, you interpret language broadly to avoid intestacy.
Just to be clear about what we said in Heiser is this court has construed strictly against the garnisher a statute in derogation of the common law. Not that we're just going to strict, that the Court of Appeals was going to strictly construct, but only if it's in derogation of the common law.
And if you look at the case law underlying that, it makes clear that the purpose of strictly construing it is in order to safeguard the rights of innocent third-party garnishees like ICANN. But at the end of the day,
I did look, and that's the Austin case. And the Austin case, as I said, had to do with due process for the garnishee. Didn't have to do with the kind of property of the garnishee. And it said, a common law, you have a right to notice. And in Austin, they weren't giving the garnishee any notice. And so that was in derogation of the common law. But it doesn't appear to be the common law that intangibles can't be attached.
Your Honor, the common law rules, I think, were broader than the statutory rules. When you switched from a garnishment proceeding from common law to statutory, you then imposed upon the courts the obligation to construe that statutory language. And I would submit it needs to be construed narrowly.
Again, but to get the words that I just quoted correctly, we're going to strictly construe where it's in derogation of the common law. That is what it says. It doesn't say we're going to strictly construe.
And I don't think there's any common law rule that allowed the attachment of all intangible property. If there were a common law rule that allowed the attachment of all intangible property, and goods and chattels included all intangible property, why on earth would you have the separate listing for the word credits? Goods and chattels would have already encompassed credits.
Why does any of this turn on D.C. law?
Your Honor, it turns on D.C. law if you want to avoid what I consider to be the slightly more difficult questions as to whether this is property that is owned by these defending countries, and hence...
But don't we have to decide that question in light of the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act?
You don't have to, Your Honor. That's what this court held in the Chalabi decision, where it made clear that you could bypass a difficult statutory jurisdictional issue under FISA in order to reach the merits, and it distinguished the statutory jurisdiction issue from the Article III jurisdictional issue.
So you assume that the IR is property under FISA? Right?
Yes.
But the question you're addressing is whether it's attachable.
Whether it's attachable property under D.C. law.
Turns on D.C. law?
Yes, Your Honor.
Rather than federal common law?
I think that under the federal rules it turns on D.C. law rather than federal common law. And I think there are, in addition to Judge Garland, to the issue we've been talking about, I think there are two other issues that don't require you to accept my understanding of goods and chattels in order to conclude that this is not attachable property under D.C. law, both the principle, really three principles, both the principle that you can't use garnishment law to insert yourself into the middle of an ongoing relationship to provide services, that the judgment creditor can't attempt to seize greater rights than the judgment debtor itself has, and the rule that the property actually has to be in the hands of the judgment creditor in order to be subject to garnishment.
There was no argument in the briefing here about the terrorism insurance provision on blocked assets. Although was that argued below?
There was certainly argument by us below, an argument by us in our briefing. We've made clear from the very beginning that that was an issue in this case, yet the plaintiffs deliberately decided not to address it either in the court below or in this court. And this is where I must take issue with one of the statements of my brethren here. They had every opportunity to address these issues. They obtained a six-week extension to their opposition to our motion to quash and had full opportunity to address these issues if they wanted, and they chose not to. Instead, they chose to, at the last minute, file a two-page, non-substantive, so-called preliminary response. When we got to this court, You may recall that during the briefing on whether the issues should be certified to the D.C. Court of Appeals, we made clear in our briefing there, too, that we were going to raise these issues. We said it. And yet again, in their opening brief, they chose to remain silent. So one very simple way to resolve this issue would be on one of the D.C. attachment law questions. Another very simple way to resolve this issue would be to say that they forfeited any arguments that this court has jurisdiction under FISA and TRIA. Either way, I don't think it requires you to address the thornier questions as to whether, in some sense, CCTLDs are property. And therefore, we would urge the court to affirm the judgment below on one of those issues.
Can you, statute in FISIA 1609, which is about attachment, says the property of the United States of a foreign state shall be immune from attachment, arrest, and execution except as provided in 1610 and 1611. Does that suggest that that is the only way to achieve attachment and we don't look at state law?
Yes.
I think it suggests that you look to state law unless there's a federal statute that governs.
No, I'm talking about the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act.
Oh, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
The proper subject to this is section 1609.
Okay.
Subject to existing international agreements. The property in the United States of a foreign state shall be immune from attachment and execution except as provided in section 1610 and 1611.
Sure.
And now those are the exceptions, the attachment exceptions.
Yeah.
So
I think those provisions go to whether this court has jurisdiction over the statutory jurisdiction over the attachment proceeding in the first place. And once you satisfy, once you make that determination, then you look to local law to determine whether it nonetheless is attachable. Once, you know, the court has jurisdiction and then can determine the attachability under local law.
Well, if that's the case, then doesn't that have to be decided first?
No, Your Honor, because that's what this court held in Chalabi and also made clear in the Kramer against Gates case. Chalabi, I can give you the cites, 543 F3rd 725, Kramer 481 F3rd 791. What Chalabi squarely holds is that you can bypass FISA, a FISA statutory jurisdictional question. Judge Randolph, you were on the panel on that case, I believe. You can bypass a statutory jurisdictional question, and it particularly involved FISA, in order to address the merits, and it distinguished it from the Steel Company Article III line of cases. It basically said Steel Company acknowledged that when you were talking about a statute as opposed to Article III jurisdiction, you didn't have to address it as a threshold matter, which is why we would urge the court to resolve this. Look, we're perfectly happy if you want to resolve it in our favor on the FISA and TRIA issues as well. But I think But I think the easier way to resolve this case would be under D.C. Attachment law, or to simply recognize that they have forfeited the FISA and TRIA questions. I'm happy to answer any further questions Your Honors have.
We don't appear to have any. Thank you.
Thank you.
Does the appellant have any time? We'll give you a couple minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. On the issue of discovery, it's impossible to go through the entire list of things that we asked for, but I refer to the court to our motion to discovery on 31 of the appendix and the exhibits thereto, the Cyrus' declaration on 36 of the appendix, and the Gelbin declaration on 49 of the appendix and all of the exhibits and attachments. There's a very long list of things. The brief only offers a very brief summary of what we asked for in discovery, and I certainly think that it reaches the issues that the counsel was talking about a second ago. Regarding goods, chattels, and credits, that phrase was codified in the D.C. Code in 1902. It goes back at least to the 1700s. It's a very old phrase. Goods, chattels, and credits, all three words together. My research suggests it might go back farther than that, probably to the late Middle Ages. I haven't been able to exactly trace it down, and that's why it doesn't appear in the briefs. But it's a very, very old phrase that refers to the process of attachment. It's been reinterpreted in modern era, as Roe v. Coppola makes clear, that it's going to apply to intangible assets, although that was true before Roe v. Coppola also. I should point out that Roe v. Coppola was decided by this court before the D.C. Court of Appeals existed. And I believe that it's binding precedent on the D.C. Court of Appeals. The D.C. Court of Appeals is free to overrule it, you know, but it was when the D.C. Court of Appeals was founded in 1970, this court's precedent became that court's precedent, I believe. We do not seek to force the Iranian citizens or anyone else with a .ir domain name to buy anything from us. That's simply not true. We simply seek ownership of the .ir domain name. People who wish to leave the .ir domain name because they don't like the new purchasers are certainly free to do so. There's not discretion on our part, like an attorney. Their example, Robbie Copa has discussed, is an attorney license.
Obviously reflects my ignorance about this. Can someone in Iran use a different country code?
They can certainly use a generic top-level domain name. They can become a .com. Whether they can use a .sy, I don't know. Mm-hmm. I mean, Iran obviously is different than the United States in terms of its law. I could buy a .ir domain name. Mm-hmm. The fact that I'm in America doesn't prevent me from doing so. I would assume that's true in Iran also, but of course Iran's processes are different. Let me just say very briefly regarding FISA. I agree that the court needs to reach FISA. I think the court cannot resolve this without reaching FISA, and I think the court can't do so without discovery. There are a lot of issues relating to whether these assets are property of that the court cannot reach, certainly cannot reach justly in a way that would be just to the CCTLD domain.
Can you say why we need to reach?
It's a jurisdictional issue.
The sovereign immunity issue.
Right. I mean, it's a jurisdictional issue, and it gets to foreign relations that I think the court would, I think it would not be wise or consistent with prudential concerns to simply ignore it. Fine.
And the reason that you didn't raise it?
Below?
That's what they say. That
the reason we didn't raise it below is because we had no time. Regarding the 6-week discovery period, it's simply not true. The processes below are discussed in the reply brief at length. I just want to point out that the writs were sent to ICANN on June 6th. ICANN took until July 28th to respond, 35 days later. We moved to compel discovery on August 11th. I can finally produce documents trying to make that motion go away on September 19th, more than a month later. We moved for discovery three business days after those documents were produced. We weren't sitting on our rights. We were being diligent. Most of the delay below was in the hands of ICANN. We did everything that we could to move things along in a way that was amicable. And we requested from, again, the district court the ability to respond fully on the merits after discovery. We expected if the district court was going to say no, it would give us the opportunity to file a merits response and did not do so. Again, on very narrow legal grounds that I think were mistaken. And from Judge Garland's questions, I think that the court agrees. And we would like to be able to go back and do this properly and create a record so that the court can review these questions properly when this case comes back. Thank you.
Further questions? All right, we'll take the matter under submission. Thank you.
Sir?
We'll take the matter under submission. Thank you.